Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchak. Today we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations at the Point Lookout Conference Center in Northport, Maine, for a talk by journalist Charles Sennett on the importance of street reporting and local journalism. The title of today's talk is Ground Truth in a Post-Truth Era. Charles Sennett is the founder, chief executive officer, and editor of the Ground Truth Project, dedicated to training the next generation of reporters to tell the most important stories of our time. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, president of Mid-Coast Forum.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the 420th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. I welcome both our members and guests who are here today and our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout Conference Center in Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. To listen to past forum presentations, find out about upcoming forum programs, and learn about how to become a member, visit our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very pleased to have with us Mr. Charles Sennett, who will be speaking on Ground Truth in a Post-Truth Era. Charles Sennett is a leading social entrepreneur of new media. In 2014, he founded the Ground Truth Project and is its chief executive officer and editor. In 2017, he launched the nonprofit organization's new local reporting initiative, Report for America. He is also the co-founder of Global Post, an acclaimed international news website. Mr. Sennett is an award-winning correspondent, best-selling author, and editor with 30 years of experience in international, national, and local journalism. He has reported from the front lines of wars and insurgencies in over 20 countries, including the post-9/11 conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq and the 2011 Arab Spring. Mr. Sennett began his career in local news covering cops, courts, and municipal governments. His extensive reporting experience led him to dedicate himself to supporting and training the next generation of journalists to report on the most important stories of our time. Previously, Mr. Sennett worked for many years as a reporter at the New York Daily News and then at the Boston Globe, where he became bureau chief for the Middle East and Europe and a leader of the paper's international coverage from 1997 to 2005. He has also served as a correspondent for PBS Frontline and the PBS NewsHour and has contributed news analysis to the BBC, CNN, NPR, MSNBC, and other news outlets. Mr. Sennett is a graduate of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Charles, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you. Thanks, George. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you, George, for the kind introduction. And thanks for inviting me into your community. This is an amazing place. I've never been up here. I had no idea you were all hiding up here. There's tremendous brain power, talent, history, knowledge in this room. And I want to go through my talk, but I'm eager to get to the questions, to hear what you're thinking about and to hear how you see the world and to ask you for some wisdom in the moment we're in, which is a very confusing moment in international affairs. So I'm going to try to go through the talk, and just a deep and very heartfelt thank you to the Mid-Atlantic Forum for inviting me. And I want to specifically thank Matt Storin, who was my boss twice at the Daily News and at the Boston Globe, and more than a boss, was a mentor and someone who really encouraged me to take some talents I had as a street reporter and to dare to bring those to the next level, to become a foreign correspondent, where, as I'll share with you today, I think that that sort of street reporting really is at the core of what makes for groundbreaking journalism. It's how you get at the big stories, is you have to be there. You have to be there on the ground. The journey I want to tell you about today is my journey going from maybe one of those last great runs in American journalism where you could start off at a small news organization and work your way up. I'm not so sure that's the pathway these days. I'm sad about that. I think it's a great path, but I think we have to find new ways and sort of think about how we can restore a pipeline for young, talented journalists to be able to get the experience they need on a local level and rise up to also cover international stories. But if we don't provide those early career opportunities for them, I'm not sure we're going to ever get back to a place where journalism has the kind of grounding and the trust that it had for so many years, in which most of the people in this room and myself remember that Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America. And today we have the President of the United States calling journalists the enemy of the people. I think that our craft, our tribe, has much to answer for the lack of trust. I think we have to reflect, we have to step back, we have to think about the failures that we've had in not listening very carefully to this country. We haven't been out there on the ground doing the reporting that really matters, and I don't want to sort of think that we're victims. I think we need to be better. We need to improve. So the journey I want to tell you about is beginning as a local reporter, taking on global issues, and a full circle back for me now to local reporting again, and really recognizing that it's the local journalism that I think we need if we're going to really restore trust in journalism. We're going to bring back the craft. I think local journalism can be a binding agent for our country. When we talk about issues that are local, whether it's whether or not to build a new school, no one knows if you're a Democrat or Republican. It might say something about how many kids you have. I have four, so I am definitely the person voting for that new school. But I have no idea if my neighbor is a Democrat or Republican in that debate. And we just need that kind of local journalism that I think can pull us together and get us to debate communities. You're lucky here in Maine. My understanding is you have pretty strong local news organizations. Getting some nods, no. We can talk about that, but New England in general, compared to many states in this union, we're in a better place than many other places in the country where there is literally no one watching the store, where they don't have people in the state house, they don't have people covering City Hall, they don't have people covering boards of education. So let me come back to that, but before we get rolling, I wanted to ask how many of you know or have heard of the technical definition of ground truth? Because there are people who would know that NASA coined this phrase, and if you have experience in the military or if you have experience in studying climatology or many different aspects that would use this very meaningful process, which is known as ground truthing. And the way NASA defines it is when you have a satellite in the sky, the technology of the satellite, of course, can read many things. We know it can read visual images, because if you've ever been on Google Earth and you've come in on your beautiful Penobscot Bay, or you've looked to see how you can locate where you are, you know how incredibly accurate these satellites can be these days. But they're not accurate unless you have a human reading on the ground that can be calibrated against the reading that the satellite is making. And if there's an error between the two, they have to recalibrate the satellite. That process is known as ground truthing. And NASA puts tremendous value on the measurement on the ground by the human being that does that measurement. That's called the human reading in the ground truthing process. It's true of all kinds of things, not just visual, right? It's barometric pressure, it's the temperatures in the ocean. You have to go out and have a human being that actually tests what the satellite's measuring and recalibrate if necessary. The reason I call our organization the Ground Truth Project is I think it's the perfect metaphor for the time we live in. We're bombarded by technology. We have satellites filled with information that beam down to us. We can get all kinds of information around the world. But if we don't have the journalists out on the ground getting the human reading, being there to calibrate all of the technology that's providing us all the other information, we won't know how accurate our readings are. And we're losing that. We're losing that globally, we're losing that nationally, and now we're losing it locally. We're losing the ability for human beings who are journalists to be out there doing their job on the ground, calibrating a very complex time. I never thought of NASA as poetic, but I love their phrase when they say, when the technology and the ground truth are in conflict, trust the human reading. So ground truth is about human readings, and that's our job, that's what we do. Some of the ways we do this revolve around many different platforms, but all of it comes down to actually being there in the field. It's been an amazing adventure for me to be a correspondent on the ground, whether that was covering cops in New York City when there was the point at which crack cocaine felt like it was ravaging New York, or whether that's being on the ground when there's stories that need to be covered, like the Oklahoma City bombing, or stories like Waco, Texas. Complex stories. I've always been on the ground. But one of the stories that had me on the ground was a police story for me. It was 1993, and it was in February, and I was in Lower Manhattan in a meeting, and there was a loud bang, and I heard it, and I heard sirens, and I did what reporters do. When you hear things go bang and you hear sirens, you go in that direction. And other people are running from that place and you're running to it. That's kind of the definition of what it is to be a foreign correspondent. But in this case, it was as a police reporter in New York City for the New York Daily News. Matt had just gone to the Globe then, back to the Globe, but I was at the Daily News. And when I got there, smoke was billowing out of the parking garage, 1993. People were arriving out of this building with soot on their face. Some were suffering a lot from smoke inhalation. Some were clearly hurting and injured and sitting on the sidewalks. And the emergency vehicles were arriving. And it was a total sort of panic and chaos. But what's interesting to me now, and I think would be interesting to all of us, is that in 1993, when smoke was billowing out of the World Trade Center parking garage, no one thought it was terrorism. The early reports were it must be a generator explosion. There were all kinds of explanations, but very, very few, and certainly not the live media that was covering it, were saying, could this be terrorism? The question wasn't really on our minds back then. By the time we got past the police lines, and I did my job, which is to nod confidently with a yellow legal pad, like you know what you're doing, and walk right in to where the crime scene is, and we saw a 4 or 5 story deep crater inside the parking garage with cars tumbled down in it. Couldn't help but think there would be many more dead than the 6 who were actually killed. But I remember seeing that and thinking, this is a bomb. I had reported in Medellin, Colombia. I had reported in Belfast. I'd seen bombings, and I knew what they looked like. And I was convinced this was a bomb. But again, when I called the desk and talked to our city editor, he was saying, what confirmation do you have? And I said, I don't have any yet. But you just have to look at it. And as we were on the phone talking, and he was saying, yeah, well, that's not quite good enough. You got to have somebody saying it. The bomb squad truck pulled up, and I told him that. This is in the age before I could have like actually done FaceTime with him on that. It was a payphone where you dropped a quarter. And for some audiences, I have to define what a payphone is. But it was meaningful, and he said, yeah, that's pretty good confirmation. Why don't you come back and let's write this? And I think we were in a time when print deadlines were such that, you know, TV had caught up to it by the evening, that the bomb squad is investigating, could this have been an explosion? And the question on the table in 1993 in February was, who would want to blow up the World Trade Center? Who would want to do that? What were the forces behind that? And as a street reporter, my job was to figure that out, and that became knocking on doors in Jersey City and in Brooklyn and going to the mosques and figuring out who are these guys. That's ground truth. That led to our editor telling me, you should go and really check this story out. You should find out who these guys are. Who is Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, the Egyptian cleric who became the sort of spiritual mastermind? Who is Ramzi Youssef, the Pakistani operative who was really the brains behind the operation? We were pretty sure the brains behind the operation was not Mohammed Salameh, who was the guy who went back to get his deposit on the truck used in the bombing at the Ryder rental place. And we had to piece this together. And the way we did our work as reporters, I think, is exactly what's needed in covering terrorism. The way the city responded, shrugging its shoulders and saying, as one detective told me, 6 people are killed in New York City every day. It was like a shrug of, it was like a New York shrug of the shoulders, and that's healthy. It was a crime, we're gonna investigate it, we're gonna go after them, and we're gonna keep going on. And sort of the resiliency of New York is the kind of resiliency I saw throughout my life in Jerusalem or in London when they had the underground bombings, or in Madrid when there were the train bombings. Cities that are resilient to this are the ones that move on and I think get healthy. And I think I'm always sort of proud of cities that do that, New York being one of them. This story of the World Trade Center became my life. There was a point in my career where I went out, basically went and did what my editor told me. I went to Egypt, I went to Pakistan, I went to the West Bank, and I started to report who are these guys. And I came back with what I thought was some pretty amazing reporting, including an intersection in 1993 in the summer in Khartoum at the People's Islamic Conference, the Islamic Conference at the People's Hall in Khartoum, where I was told there was a gentleman in the back of the room known as the Emir, very tall, white robes, and that was, of course, Osama bin Laden. And in Khartoum at that point, interviewing Hassan al-Turabi, the spiritual head of the Sudan, I realized I was really seeing something unfolding before my eyes, which was a coalescing of forces coming together against the United States of America. I sympathize with the FBI, CIA, who didn't put it all together. It was very hard to see. It was like a photograph developing in a chemical bath. And I'm in an audience that would know what I'm talking about. But I do feel like we were watching nascent al-Qaeda. And I got frustrated with the Daily News because it didn't get the story. It got the cop story, but I'm not sure it got the bigger story. I won't go into how I confronted our new editor-in-chief at the Daily News about his not getting the story, but it wasn't pleasant. It involved a conversation that involved a few F-bombs and a few, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And next thing I knew, I was basically slamming his office door, and I realized I might have just quit. But I know there's a guy I might be able to call who might be able to help me out here. And I called Matt Storin and was able to take that moment in my life where I was on the edge of a really big story. And Matt offered me a job at the Boston Globe, and I am from Boston. And that job was to come and work at the Globe, and there could be an opening for a Middle East bureau chief slot. And if there is, you would be in line for that. And Matt stayed true to his word, and I will always remember him for that. He gave me that opportunity. And when my wife and I moved back to Boston, for me back, she's from New York. Matt also knew the only way I was ever going to get her to marry me and move to Boston was to actually have a job in Boston. Did that, and we had a child born, and right at the edge of all this happening. So with a 3-week-old son, we moved to Jerusalem, and we began a journey of really covering nascent al-Qaeda. 8 years later, I've already covered the rise of the Intifada. I've been covering a lot of the region's tumult, whether that was the war in Algeria, which no one was covering, but we were watching it, or whether it was the police state that was really ossifying inside of Egypt. All those forces that became so important in understanding al-Qaeda were at work, and I was covering them. But it was September of 2001 that the bus bombings and the bombings by Hamas in Jerusalem got so bad that the Globe decided maybe it's smart to get your family out of there. Why don't you move to London? We arrived in London September 5th, 2001. Moving truck came September 11th, 2001. And I had just said to my wife, Julie, blue blazer, Eurostar, whole new beginning, no more Middle East, this will be amazing. That was like 8 a.m. London time. We all know what happened by midday London time, and the world had changed, and I knew I'd be on my way. This picture is from reporting in Afghanistan. I don't know the exact date of this picture. I think it's either 2002 or 3. It is really a time when I felt like that reporting, that ground truth on the edge, was really something I could add value to. So I had children, and my wife and I had 3 more during this time of covering the aftermath of 9/11. But it was worth it to me. It was value added. It was ground truth. It was what I could do to try to help us calibrate this attack on our country. So all these press passes were from all those that ground truth, but this was the one that felt to me like a turning point in your life where you feel like you really have something to add. And I know there are many people in this room who've added to our nation's understanding of things, but this is what we do as journalists.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Charles Sennett discussing the power of local journalism.
In doing this, I began to really think about the next generation of journalists. What kind of opportunities are they going to get? So after reporting on the front lines in Afghanistan and Iraq for about 5 years, I came back and the Globe gave me a really great opportunity to do the Nieman Fellowship. And in the Nieman Fellowship, I thought about this industry we're in. And I thought about how precipitously it was declining, what needed to be done. And I knew I had some entrepreneurial skills and some energy, and I wanted to think about how I could create something. And I created an organization called Global Post. I was the co-founder of it. I sort of was the editorial chief. There was a business chief. Very proud of the work we did editorially. We had 70 freelancers in 50 countries. But the model, the business model, which was for profit, was insufficient to sustain the work we needed to do. I didn't have the Boston Globe behind me. I didn't have the wherewithal of a big news organization and the support services we need. And while it was entrepreneurial and it was exciting and it was a startup, there was also a moment where I realized if we're going to really put people in the field, they have to have the right training, they have to have the resources. And at that time, I was really lucky to work with a journalist named Jim Foley. Jim Foley worked for us at Global Post and did extraordinary work. He really was truly one of the most interesting young people I'd worked with in my time at Global Post. He had a tremendous commitment to public service. He did 2 years with Teach for America before he became a journalist. He taught literacy to inmates inside of Chicago jails. He was one of those people who took his Jesuit training at Marquette really seriously and had a passion for social justice and a passion for service. And I really admired him and I loved him. And when Jim got captured inside Syria, it was the worst day I've ever had professionally. And it was a moment where you realized that this nexus between the need for new models in journalism and the lack of support for them has now hit a ripsaw of reality. And we have to think about how we're really going to do this. For Jim, he was captured in 2012. It was right at the time I was moving from Global Post to really building out a different model called the Ground Truth Project, which was nonprofit. So not for-profit model, but a nonprofit model with support from the Ford Foundation. And soon we would get support from other foundations and other individuals, and we could really grow it. The day we got our 501c3 was July 2014, and it's within a few days of putting together the press release of announcing the Ground Truth Project and a different model to support them that we got the news that Jim was killed. And the news was devastating. And it was sort of a rallying point for those of us who do this work that we have to be better at providing support for journalists in the field, because it has never been more dangerous to be a journalist covering the world than it is right now. We're all used to being caught in a crossfire. That goes with the terrain, right? So if I was covering Lebanon or if I was covering clashes in the West Bank, crossfire was real. You had to think about it. And we used to wear press on our vests or put it on our cars. And you'd say, okay, it's the risk you take. You go into the middle of the conflict and you try to stay out of the crossfire. Now, journalists are in the crosshairs. Now journalists are targeted. Jim Foley was sort of a a moment in our nation's history where I think that became so glaringly clear that his case stands as one that I think pulled us together to do things. We now have an organization called the Culture of Safety, which really pulls together safety standards for journalists in the field. Jim inspires me every day. The Ground Truth Project is largely about trying to help this new generation get the support, the resources, the training they need to do extraordinary work. And we are emboldened and empowered by Jim's living legacy all the time. We work very closely with his family, the Foley family in New Hampshire, have the James Foley Legacy Foundation, and we have a fellowship right now that we're about to announce that's in Jim's honor. So I want you to know he's at the core of what we do. And that core is really about this next generation and how are we going to support them. The kind of work we do is multimedia and it's cross-platform, and we partner with other news organizations. So for example, when we have our immersive multimedia series on climate change called The Last Generation, about the Marshall Islands and about young people who are in the middle of having to leave that island because it will not be there for them and they're not going to have their kids there. So we did climate change through the eyes of children. And we did this with Frontline. And I'd invite you to really check it out. It's immersive. We're working with PBS Educational Services to put it in schools. It's the kind of work we can do. And the two young journalists who worked on this, truly extraordinary. We're really proud of that project. It's won a lot of big awards. When we work in Ground Truth Films, Beth Murphy, who is the head of Ground Truth Films for us, has been doing work in Afghanistan. Her award-winning film is called What Tomorrow Brings. It's about a girls' school, and she's put years of working inside that school. She works with young Afghan journalists, women, and the unique access to the schools is extraordinary. Our podcast, the Ground Truth Podcast, how many of you are listening to podcasts here in the dead of winter? Okay, I really want to invite you to please check out the Ground Truth Podcast. Please give it a listen. I want your feedback on it. It's one of the things I'm the most excited about that we do. We work with young journalists. We give them an opportunity to do deep, immersive reporting through podcasts. The same with photography. When we do these projects, we're looking at issues around the world, whether it's in North Korea or big issues like income inequality. Very proud of this project, which we did with support from the Ford Foundation. I told you about The Last Generation. This is the series we did in Afghanistan, so building off of the work I had done and now working with a new generation of journalists there. Our biggest movement right now is to try to study populist authoritarianism around the world, and we just launched this. So we've announced a call for applications to cover populist authoritarianism, and we're looking for young journalists in Poland, Hungary, Brazil, the Philippines, the United States of America, to cover this trend, which is disturbing and that is rippling through the world. We want to really invite these. If you know young people who would be interested in this, please encourage them to apply. Why are we doing this? Trust in the media is absolutely plummeting. We all know that. There's no way we can put ourselves up against a White House that is calling us the enemy of the people and not feel like we're being partisan. I hate getting boxed in like that. We have to think of a way we can be tough and aggressive about what we do and not allow ourselves to resort to partisan divides. Stay true to our course. As Bill Belichick says, we got to do our job. But it is undeniable that when I got into this business, I was a kid, I was listening to the radio for the Watergate hearings live. Woodward and Bernstein were heroes. I am of that generation, inspired by them. The guy whose live radio reports I listened to was Danny Schechter, your news dissector on WBCN in Boston. And it was absolutely formation for me. But look at where we are from the view of journalists from that time to today. We, I think, again, have a lot to answer for on that. The danger to journalists doing this job in the field is extraordinary, and it's getting worse, not better. The fear that journalists feel in the field is extraordinary, and it's something, again, that we are working very hard on. And it's not just American journalists in the field. It's also, of course, the attacks on Charlie Hebdo in Paris and in our own country, an attack inside the Capitol newsroom and what that meant to that news organization and to our country when we have this happening in our own, right here in our own country. The biggest and most frightening oppression of journalists in our country and around the world is against women. Women are being targeted specifically and harassed repeatedly. And these numbers are chilling. That 2/3 of emerging women journalists have been harassed or directly threatened. 1 in 10 has been directly attacked. That is extraordinary. And we need to do something about that. So as a result, we're seeing that 1 in 3 are considering leaving the profession. So I'm talking about trying to restore trust in the profession. One of the things we have to do is defend women in particular against these attacks. In general, my belief is that the crisis in journalism has become a crisis for our democracy. And that's why I'm talking to you about the crisis in reporting globally and locally, because I think it's now gotten to the point where it's eroding the cornerstone of our democracy. The way we are seeing this is in news deserts spreading across the country. This is the picture of the Denver Post staff in 2013 when they won the Pulitzer Prize. And those faces that are blackened out, and if you see, it's the vast majority of them. Those are people who no longer work at the paper. The gutting of great newsrooms is happening right now, right in front of us, and it's unfolding in real time. Local reporting especially is declining. When I started Global Post, I was really focused on the decline in international reporting. Now, it's really gotten down to the local level. If you look at the number of journalists who've been just dropping out of our craft, it's extraordinary. And it is going further. Those statistics are 2015, 2016. The decline has continued. Last month, there were hundreds of jobs lost. Dallas Morning News announced layoffs. You probably read about BuzzFeed announcing layoffs. You probably read about this threat to Gannett for a hostile takeover, which could mean a lot of layoffs. This is in real time. Amid that, the manipulation of news is growing. One reflection of that, when I was young, way back in the 80s and starting in on this career in college newspapers, it was pretty much a one-to-one battle, PR against journalists. We are so vastly outnumbered now by public relations, communications. It's tough to message the truth against people who have their own truths and their own interests who are countering all the time. Why should we care? Because stories aren't getting covered, because communities aren't getting covered, and if we don't have eyes in our own community, we don't have eyes in the world, there's no way we can understand the complicated time we live in. So I think what we're seeing now in our country being as divided as it is one of the impacts of what happens when journalism is this eroded, is this undercut. I think we start to stop listening to each other as a country because we can't share the same set of facts. When we stop doing that, we resort to extremes on cable television, MSNBC on the left, Fox News on the right. We stop reading local newspapers because they don't cover our community, and suddenly every issue is nationalized. We're debating abortion and we're debating the Second Amendment, but we're not talking about those issues that bind us together because they aren't getting covered. So I really think there's something in the fabric of American democracy that needs local reporting, and it's become a big national issue for us to get back away from this divided moment. I think supporting local reporting can have a role in that. The solution we put forward is a new program we've started called Report for America. Report for America is inspired by Teach for America. It's inspired by City Year. It's inspired by the Peace Corps. It's inspired by any corps that sees itself as providing service. And we are literally putting out a call to a new generation of journalists to say, we need you to do the service of reporting on local communities across the country, in newsrooms that are dying and in communities that need that coverage. We have 13 reporters in 2018 in the field in 9 newsrooms. We just announced we're hiring 60 reporters this year, and we're on our way to funding 250 reporters in 2020. We want this to become a movement. We want to try to get 1,000 reporters in the field by 2022. It's a big goal, but we've got growing support for this from many, from the Ford Foundation, from the Knight Foundation, which has been an early supporter and we're hoping going to be a continuing supporter. We've had support from the Google News Initiative and from Facebook. We also have a lot of support from individuals and from communities that are seeing that this is a real opportunity for them to restore local reporting. These are some of the people who we've hired. We're 2/3 women, more than half are people of color. I think we're trying to really revitalize local journalism, and these young people are doing extraordinary work. That's Report for America. That's what we do. And all of this is tied together as part of Ground Truth. Because I think to go back to that NASA definition, if we're going to get through this moment, if we're going to really get out of the divide we're in, we need good journalism. We're going to need to do what NASA defined as ground truth, and that is trust the human reading. Thank you.
This is Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Charles Sennett will now answer questions from the audience.
Thank you very much, Charles. You've, I think, given us an awful lot to think about. While they're collecting questions from our members, I'd like to start by asking a question of my own. You've talked here about recruiting these new young journalists. What opportunities are going to exist for them once they go through your program and your support? Are the jobs still out there for them, or are those jobs disappearing?
It's a great question. So we work with all kinds of news organizations. We work with small newspapers, weekly and daily newspapers. We work with public radio stations. We work with new digital media startups, like Mississippi Today is a new startup news organization, all digital in Mississippi, trying to serve all of the state of Mississippi. We've put two reporters into the Mississippi Delta because that area in particular is not getting any coverage. The answer is the good digital startups will be around. Public radio is strong but needs support. Newspapers won't be around as long as they call themselves newspapers. Now, I love reading the print edition. I'm with you. Most of you, I think, would agree. There is nothing like it. It's a tactile experience to hold that printed edition. And we can always make that a product that's available. But if you call yourself a newspaper, you're done. You're a news organization that has a product called the newspaper, but you have to be online. You have to be fully digital. You have to be mobile first. You have to be doing video. I work with just even a small newspaper in my community, small town called Harvard, Massachusetts, which is central Massachusetts. It's an apple town. It's small, 5,000 residents. More, maybe 6,000. But the newspaper, the Harvard Press, I'm working with them all the time. They're really innovative. They're really creative. I think they're going to do well. I think they're struggling right now, but I think they actually could find a path forward. I think local newspapers in America have a shot at finding their path into the future, but they're going to have to work hard. So to answer your question, George, some will stay in the places they are. Others, we hope, will go and learn lessons from a generation of reporters who really know the good stuff. And we want to try to get a new generation connected with that. And like Teach for America, we're not considering it a failure if they don't stay in journalism. If they go into journalism and they learn the value of it and they become part of a movement for journalism reform, we think that's great. If they go on to law school, I mean, I'd forgive them for doing that. But they might go and become lawyers, or they might become public policy people. They might work in government. But if they've worked in a newsroom, they know what it is. And we want to make sure that those who want that opportunity can do it. It's also just an extraordinary adventure for young people. I had so much fun doing this job. Matt knows this. I really had a blast. I still am, actually. It's a career. It's a life. It's a way of allowing yourself to open up to communities, to hear what they're talking about and share those stories. Tremendous craft that I want a new generation to experience. So we're hoping there'll be green shoots in news deserts. We're hoping they'll be inspired to come up with new models for journalism, and that this will be a start on a path for them. So I hope that answers you, George.
Well, it does. I see we have a huge number of questions here.
Okay.
We'll
You're
get
bundling.
To as many as we possibly can. One is there a continuing role for the nonprofit sector in supporting journalism and the on-the-ground reporting process?
That's a great question. So, you know, I shared with you, I worked in traditional media for years. I started off at WFCR, a tiny public radio station in western New England. I then went into newspapers. I worked at the Bergen Record. I worked for the New York Daily News. Then I went to the Globe. I was at the Globe for almost 15 years. And then when I started Global Post, that was a for-profit startup. And we had a business model that was based on advertising. That business model did not succeed. We were in the middle of watching digital advertising rates plummet And what that means is then you have to drive your traffic up if you're going to get enough money to have a viable business. How do you drive your traffic up online? You write about ridiculous things with really big headlines. And I don't want to do that. So I realized that the business models of the digital era require a kind of compromise that I did not want to make. And that's why, for me, the journey was making a lot of sense to try to shift to a nonprofit sector. If you think about some of the healthiest news organizations we have in this country, PBS NewsHour, okay, it's a little sleepy sometimes, but it is also an extraordinarily balanced, fair approach to journalism. I learn a lot listening to it. I value it. I think it really has a place in our media landscape. National Public Radio, extraordinary service for the whole country, both local and national and foreign. If you think about PBS, I mean, I have been really lucky to have the Ground Truth Project be invited to be based at WGBH. We're independent of WGBH in Boston, but we're housed there. That is a community of excellence that's extraordinary. A lot of us in New England don't realize WGBH is a powerhouse of production for the PBS system nationally. That's where Frontline is produced. That's where Nova is produced. Some of the best journalism done in America is produced there. We partner, as I shared with you, with Frontline. I think it's the best documentary unit in America. So already the nonprofit sector plays a big role. I think that's the place for growth. If we think of nonprofits as these sleepy, frumpy, tweety things where you're just putting your hand out all the time, we won't succeed. But if you think about the nonprofit sector as a way to leverage tremendous wealth in this country and to have it work towards social good, that's why it's one of the fastest growing sectors in our economy. I have never heard anyone say that nonprofit business model doesn't work in higher education. You know, look at the endowments of major universities in our country. They are doing fine. They are making a lot of money. They are very viable businesses. Look at hospitals that are nonprofit. A lot of them function as businesses very well and are communities of excellence and places of excellence. Journalism is going to need to find a way for the nonprofit sector to play a greater and greater role. Report for America is part of that, not only because we bring in national funding, but we talk to local communities about finding local funding so local foundations can get a national match through us to support reporters in their community.
You've commented on the steep decline in the number of veteran reporters. So don't you need the veteran reporters to train the young, new, enterprising reporters?
We really do. And we're trying to figure out a way to create a mentoring community so that we can have those veteran reporters really teach a new generation. So with being accepted as a Report for America host news organization comes the obligation that you've connected a mentor to that young reporter. That you have to do that in order to be accepted into our program. We're also wondering if we can't open up for all those journalists who've taken buyouts or who have retired, who've gone into different fields, pull them together because there's great knowledge base out there where we can have them really mentor a new generation. So the answer is, yeah, we need them. We just need to find out a way to be sure they're part of the mix with us.
Here's a question related to the fact that, and it's not just with news, but across the board, we're getting consolidation of industries. And that is, what are you observing in terms of media monopolies and how this is affecting reporting?
It's a great question. How many of you know about Alden? Read about Alden Group. Read about the kind of forces that are, it's vulture capitalism at its worst. There are organizations that are really going out to buy newspapers cheap, to take the real estate, drain them from the little bit of profit they can get out of them, and just let them crash on the rocks of history. They don't really seem to care that much what happens. I'm sure representatives of Alden Group would take a different point of view, and I'd like to hear that. But that is absolutely the perspective we're seeing through the way they are penetrating the purchase of local newspapers around the country. And we have to be aware that there are economic forces at play here. Newspapers missed the boat on the digital economy. That's their fault. They have a lot to answer for. But we have to be aware that they're struggling. We have to be aware that there are forces that are pushing them over the edge intentionally. And there is a collective need to be concerned about that, to recognize the public service role that journalism plays, and to see that maybe that means you got to step up and support Maine Public Radio. You got to step up and support public television. You got to step up and support the things that are going to try to get in this space, because right now the economic models are pushing journalism down. They're pushing it to the side. And I, as I've said, I really think that's hurting our democracy.
There are a couple in this vein, but this one's let me read it. Do you think you can find conservative support for Report for America? Do you get support from across the board?
We're eager to. We're seeking it out, and we have some. We have on our board, we have several people from Fox News. We are deeply nonpartisan. We don't want to let this become a left-leaning organization that's going to try to prop up some political point of view. I've never, ever approached my reporting with that sort of steel trap of partisan politics. It creates terrible journalism. And you see that every day if you watch MSNBC, and you see it every day if you watch Fox. Aren't they getting really boring? I don't even care which one you watch. They're just boring. You know exactly what they're going to say. It's as if they're reading from a script, and it's not interesting. Matt and I were at dinner last night with some of you here. We were talking about a story on welfare reform. Boston Globe, big liberal newspaper, ended up reporting a very unlikely story that Matt saw, encouraged my editor to tell me to go out and check on it. It was one of these stories that transformed the debate on welfare in Massachusetts because it wasn't predictable. It was about the failures of the welfare system, not a defense of the welfare system. And we have to have the courage to do that kind of reporting if we're going to make a difference. It's the hardest reporting to do, but it's the best reporting there is. So I think not only does it have a place, it's going to have a place. We need to have it. Report for America and Ground Truth have to be very inclusive organizations if we're going to succeed, and them being good journalism organizations.
So we have a number of questions here about the impact of the electronic media on reporting. And I just want to go through a series of them, but if I read them all at once, I think you'd be overwhelmed. But with all the instant online reporters, how can the new generation of reporters use current technologies to impress truth on the viewers and readers?
So we're working a lot with Google and with Facebook. They are helping us to learn the digital tools that are available through them to be able to do really sophisticated reporting. One quick example, the Google News Initiative teaches our young journalists how to do geofencing. What that means is you could take this area of Penobscot Bay and you could say, what is trending here right now? And in doing that, you'll find what are the big questions right here. So what they've shown us is that if journalists had done this, for example, in Flint, Michigan, in the years or even months before the water crisis really broke as a national story, they would have seen people asking about their water and the lack of access to clean water. So there are these digital tools we can use to get a read on communities, to find out what's really happening there. We've got to get better at that. Social media is, of course, the bane of our existence, but it's also a huge opportunity to communicate. And I don't think we need to be against social media. We need to realize it's a tool. It's a tool that can be used well. It's a tool that can be used for ill. But we have to find ways to draw on a generation that's really sophisticated about it as digital natives and allow them to find paths forward, but grounded by those good lessons that will come from mentoring, from editing, and from really adhering to the traditions of journalism that really are why American journalism was respected for so long. We've got to keep those alive if we're going to use the digital tools.
Well, this one's closely related, but I'm not sure you've addressed it directly. How does the rise of blogging affect the future of traditional journalism?
You know, a lot of this generation of journalists, from my experience working with them, we've done almost 200 global reporting fellowships. We now have 13 Report for America Corps members, but we're about to have 60. We look at applications and resumes. We deal with young journalists every day, and they all have too many opinions. It's like, I don't care what your opinion is. They've learned through blogging, I think, this fast, rapid reaction rather than the deliberative step back and just think about what you're going to write. I remember being in newsrooms where I spent half the day thinking about what's the lead? Like, how do I capture this in a way that will be fair, that will push the story forward, that will be insightful, that won't be weak, but will be fair? How do you tell people what to think about without trying to tell them what to think? That's the challenge. And I think it's a generation that's gotten too quick to react, too quick to respond, and an emphasis on speed over reflection. And I don't really know how we short-circuit that, except to get them into newsrooms where they're going to get in a lot of trouble for doing that. And let them have the sweat that we used to have. You used to wake up in the middle of the night if you thought you got something wrong and call the copy desk and say, wait, I got to check this. That kind of compulsion for accuracy came from hard, fast, fixed, real analog deadlines. In the digital age, we've got to find a way to create a culture for that accuracy and excellence. I'm puzzled to how we might do it. Maybe in the conversation after, if you have any ideas, let me know.
And this one is kind of a little bit on the opposite. Can we have a strong, trustworthy local journalism without print newspapers? That is, can the electronic media at least partially offset the decline in local news?
I really think we can. I think there's really exciting things happening with local news in the digital realm. I don't know a lot about what's happening here in Maine. I'd love to hear your thoughts. But I mean, how many of you listen to even Maine Public Radio digitally? How many of you go online to listen? Yeah, so I mean, the digital stories that Maine Public Radio puts out are really important contributions to digital news organizations. So it's no longer just the radio. It's also podcasting. It's also having organizations like public radio stations reporting print stories, text stories, and video. The convergence of platforms is the moment we live in. I think all news organizations are going to have to be digital. So yeah, newspapers are great traditions. We've got to bring them along into this exciting future. I am not down on the moment we live in. We are in a revolutionary moment for media. It's the most exciting time in many generations to become a journalist. But we need to find the ways to pull the through line for excellence and standards. And then I think there's a really exciting set of opportunities around how you tell stories in the digital age.
Here's one. Someone wants to know what's going to be the future of electronic media. Will the Chinese example of control of what information goes to the people become more widespread throughout the world?
This is a room that knows very well that truth has been manipulated for many, many years, many generations, many ages, through time. It's never have we lived on a planet where there were not forces that were trying to manipulate facts and the truth. And in the Cold War, we called it disinformation. And we understood that a large part of Soviet strategy was disinformation campaigns. And they got really good at it. And the head of their KGB is still good at it. We understand that China has sought to control media in its country. And we have a president of the United States who I hope jokingly when he referenced how much he admires the state control of the media. Did you remember this comment from President Trump? There are these forces at play, and we're going to have to be sure that we check them. I don't think there's any country in the world more well-positioned to defend this notion of the importance of a free press. I've reported all over the world. I love the French. They are very fawning of their government. I love the British, and their media is to be admired and to be emulated. But it's also really partisan. The print newspapers are just like the Guardians on the left. You know, you got the Daily Telegraph on the right. The BBC is the bulwark of their great journalism. We look across a landscape in America where we should be aware how important this is to who we are and how we project out to the world. I know this room knows that. We've got to get that communicated to a new generation that's worried about questions like this. We have traditions, we have standards, we have to live up to them. And I am very patriotic this way. It's why Report for America has this sort of red, white, and blue feel to it. I think this is a time for journalists to stop being so cynical about things like public service. My colleague who's helping me get Report for America off the ground, Steve Waldman, really inspiring model he's come up with, and I really want to give him a shout out because he really understood the need for public service in journalism, and he worked with AmeriCorps, and he's really studied that journalism has much to learn from the public service movements that really created a transformation in education reform through Teach for America. I hope journalism can have that through Report for America. That's the insight, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, then to follow up on that, how can we as individuals vet the digital news sources like those of Apple News or Microsoft News or whatever, the feeds we get that
yeah.
So use a lot of different sources?
You know, it's media literacy in the digital age. It's not that much different than media literacy in the 1970s when you would go into the supermarket and you would see at the checkout counter the Weekly World News or an organization still in the news, the National Enquirer. And you would look at these and you would realize these screaming headlines about Martians landing in LA weren't true, right? And you wouldn't buy them, or maybe you would buy them as a joke, or I don't know who bought them. But why is it much different today? We knew there were organizations that had traditions for truth and traditions for standards of excellence, and you would filter them through. It moves fast and furious now. But this room is full of people who know how to fact check. This room is full of people who understand that you can easily figure out if an article you've just read is fake news, because you can go check it against the BBC or you can check it against the news organizations you trust. And I think it's why those news organizations we trust aren't going to go away anytime soon, because they are going to become the grounding for us to calibrate or get at that ground truth of information in this age. We're going to need those. I think there's also sophisticated ways that people are looking at things, like the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University right now is working with a team that's really looking at real-time examinations of fake news campaigns. And when Macron was facing that scandal on the eve of the election in France, do you remember when they said he had, accounts in the Bahamas or something that he was trumping up? Well, there was a whole team at Shorenstein who swarmed that and realized that these receipts were made up, they were fake. They did a sort of digital forensic study of the story, and in real time, within a few days, they dispelled that story, and they showed that it was forces on the far right trying to work against him, and voila, it was out there. I think we're going to need that kind of aggressive real-time reporting in this digital age. We're going to have to step it up, but it's there, and there are people working on it, and there are organizations that are doing it and doing a pretty good job at it.
Well, I wish we had time for a lot more questions, but unfortunately we don't. So I wanted to thank you very much
for
your excellent presentation.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Charles Sennett, the founder, chief executive officer, and editor of the Ground Truth Project. He recently spoke with the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations on the power of local journalism. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.